24-year-old Jennifer Kessy disappeared January 24, 2006. She was last seen at her condo on Conroy Road.
We're going to solve a missing persons case, which has haunted Orlando investigators.
So we're still waiting for that one person to come through with the one bit of information that could bring Jennifer home.
This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigation into the 2006 disappearance of Jennifer Kessy from Orlando, Florida. I'm Sean Gerd. In many of our episodes to date, we've discussed possibilities. The possibilities of new information, the possibilities of why Jennifer was abducted in the first place, and the possibilities of who may be responsible. But today we're going to look at what we think isn't as likely to be a possibility. We've reached a point where moving forward in any of these previously mentioned directions, the possibilities as it were, has become immensely more time consuming. And that's not to say that we're not moving forward in those directions, but it's a grind. And we wanted, needed really, to put out an episode since, let's face it, it's been a while. And so while that grind continues on, we're going to take a chance to address something that we put on the back burner for quite a while. Something that we'd always thought was somewhat unlikely, but couldn't completely rule out. These questions revolve around a known serial killer, with connections to Orlando, and who was operating during the time of Jennifer's disappearance. His name? Israel Keyes. Now maybe the name's familiar to you, maybe it's not. But it definitely wasn't to me. I'd never even heard of Israel Keyes until after we'd started looking into Jennifer's disappearance, and saw some people speculating about his involvement on the internet, and even then, I didn't really pay it much mind. It wasn't until we were months into producing this podcast that we started getting contacted by listeners, asking us to take a look at Keyes. And it was one particular email that seemed somewhat compelling. At least enough that I spent some time looking into him, and considering his possible involvement in Jennifer's disappearance. And Scott and I have been doing that off and on for the last several months. But it wasn't until I had an opportunity to talk with someone with far more knowledge than myself that it was time for Scott and I to make a decision and put that out there for all of you. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, so let's go back real quick. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Keyes, here's the basics. Israel Keyes was a serial killer, a rapist, and a robber who is known to have been committing violent crimes as early as 1996, and up until 2012 when he was arrested and later committed suicide while in prison. Keyes spent his early years living in the Pacific Northwest. He was born in Utah, but raised in Washington State, and he would later move to Alaska. He joined the military, serving 4 years in the U.S. Army. He was stationed at Fort Lewis in Washington State and Fort Hood in Texas. And he would later work as a handyman, contractor, and construction worker after his discharge from the Army in 2001. And for those of you familiar with the theories in Jennifer's case, the mere mention of construction worker probably gets people looking in his direction. Keyes' victims were usually far from where he lived, many in the northeast of the United States, and he didn't have a victim profile, which is odd for a serial killer, and probably why some people thought that Jennifer could be a possibility. He is suspected of killing upwards of a dozen people, and perhaps more, with a myriad of other crimes and robberies and burglaries thrown in. But could he be responsible for Jennifer's disappearance? Before we go on, I want to tell you about a new podcast I love. If you're a fan of Unconcluded, you probably love true crime. And when you think of a criminal, what do you picture? Do you picture a murderer? A gangster? A thief? Do you picture a woman? Probably not. And that's why I'm hooked on the new podcast, Female Criminals. Every week, the hosts of Female Criminals take a psychological approach to analyzing the stories and motivations of the women behind some of the world's most dangerous crimes. Each episode analyzes the psychology of these criminals and looks into their minds to better understand their motives. The hosts dive deep into the lives of the infamous female criminals, providing listeners with each woman's backstory and the details of her crimes. You can check out episodes on The Cocaine Goddess now, and a new episode comes out every Wednesday. You can expect episodes on Eileen Wuornos and Mata Hari and many more. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and search for Female Criminals. Again, that's FemaleCriminals. Or visit Parcast.com/criminals to start listening now. That's Parcast, Parcast.com/criminals to listen now. Let's go back to that email that I mentioned earlier. The email that made a somewhat compelling case for the possibility of Israel Keyes, serial killer, being involved in Jennifer's disappearance. Here's some of the highlights from that email. Keyes' physical description, other than height, is strikingly similar to the Jennifer Kessie person of interest. Additionally, the clothing and hairstyle of Keyes throughout the years are consistent with the POI video and stills. Some people think that the POI video in Jennifer's case is wearing a bike helmet. Keyes was a known avid biker. Keyes' abduction of one woman was in a parking lot with people around. So it's not a stretch to think that he could have attacked Jennifer at her car, even in the daylight or with others around. Additionally, Keyes also had a history of home evasions going all the way back to his high school years. And also he had abducted a couple from their home and successfully moved and hid them. The police said in that case that there was no disturbance and no indication of foul play in the home. No physical evidence. If he could abduct two grown adults and leave no traces, he could have done it with one. Also, Keyes traveled to Orlando quite a few times, having family there and also a childhood friend that lived nearby. Keyes was seen driving the victim's car the day after they were reported missing, and also admitted to sometimes moving victims' cars to confuse investigators, or to slow the discovery of evidence. In one case, the victim's car was found in a parking lot just 1.5 miles from their home. Keyes always removed the battery from his cell phone, and did the same to his victims' phones. And when he was arrested, his last victim's phone was found on him. Obviously, this connects to the battery removal and Jennifer's case. Keyes himself stated that some of his victims were not classified as murders, but missing persons. When the police interviewed him and suggested that he should give names because local, small-town cops would get wind of him and try to pin every unsolved crime on him, he simply replied, "I don't think they'd go for that. They've got to have remains at least," which was followed by a laugh. Keyes also admitted to taking two single victims between 2005 and 2006. But these have not been narrowed down yet publicly by the FBI. Also, a potential explanation for Orlando, Keyes explained a fondness for hunting victims in areas during hurricane season, because it was easier for people to go missing and stay missing. These were just some of the interesting points from that email that at least made me pause and think. And they're why Scott and I continued to think about the possibility over the months. We attempted to fact-check most of the claims, and most of them did check out, although I did have trouble locating some of the information. But it didn't seem to be made up. And so it was always just there, kind of in the back of our minds. Maybe that was someone that we should look closer at later on. But as I mentioned earlier, I had the chance to talk to someone who knows much more about Keyes. And really, the conversation confirmed a lot of my thinking. The voice you're about to hear is Josh Hallmark. He's the host of several popular podcasts, none of which revolve around a murder or a missing person. You may know him from the Karen and Ellen Letters, Our Americana, or the Playlist podcast. And if you're not familiar with those podcasts, I encourage you to check them out, and I enjoy them. In fact, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about them at the end of the episode. But the reason I was so interested in talking to Josh wasn't any of those shows. It was because I found out that there was another project that he'd been working on.
Yeah, so I've been working on a Keys podcast for just under 2 years now. I haven't been devoted to it because I have four other projects, but it's been kind of in between time. And when I'm traveling, I spend a lot of time researching it. And we just sent away for the FOIA a few weeks ago and are waiting for that. And that's like 12,000 documents. So it's kind of kicking into gear. And I'm hoping to have it released in October. But I have researched him heavily and have become kind of obsessed with him, not as a human being, obviously, but right. Like what I found so interesting about him is that he didn't really have a victim profile and his MO was kind of all over the place. The only real link between the way he operated is just being eerily meticulous. And I love the flip side of the mystery that we weren't looking for a killer. We were looking for victims because they've only been able to identify three of his victims. There's a fourth that they're pretty certain was one of his, but they think that he's killed as many as 11 to 15 people. And so I thought it was interesting and really sad, actually, for those other, you know, 11 people, for their families to not know what happened to them. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, it flipped the true crime genre kind of on its head, where it was true crime in reverse almost. So, you know, it's funny when you reached out, Jennifer, because he was never on my radar at all because for a myriad of reasons, she goes against kind of the way he operated. But after you reached out to me, I did deep dive her case and looked at the links between the two and came up pretty short. And we can talk about why he would not be a good suspect for that, if you'd like. I broke it down into 5 years, and I want to start with the psychology of true crime aficionados, because that's something I'm going to be reporting on pretty heavily in my podcast. But what I think is really interesting that most of us who are into true crime do is we tend to want to believe that every unsolved crime is committed by, quote unquote, a famous serial killer. And I think that we do that because, A, we want to live in a world where there's only 10 people killing people, and B, because of familiarity. And I think, sadly, that's just not the case. You know, there are a lot of statistics about how many serial killers are out in the world at any given time, but the most common one is about 100 to 200. So, you know, I think we're on a first-name basis as true crime fans with probably 40 serial killers. So it's nice to believe that every unsolved crime is committed by one of those, but statistically, that's just not the case. And then going back to familiarity, when we look into true crime and when we look at pictures and just out in the world, like we look for things in others that are familiar to ourselves. So when we see that grainy picture of this suspect, you know, we look for how it's familiar in our own lives. And I think when you marry those two concepts of wanting to believe it's one of the big name killers and looking for familiarity, we can, you know, trick ourselves into seeing Israel Keys in that grainy picture where really you can't see anybody. I mean, you know, it's nice to believe these things, but it's just not the case, unfortunately. And so I want to go into specifics. I think first, starting with Orlando, to support the idea, yes, he did travel to where his family members were. However, the only documentation I can find in FBI files and just searches and books that I've read is him doing that in the Northeast. So flying into Maine, where most of his family lived, and traveling from there into New York, Vermont, New Jersey to commit his crime. In fact, looking through what I have, there's nothing that really links him to being in the Orlando area in 2006. We have him in New Orleans in 2012, but that's the closest time that we have them in or around the Orlando area. And then in 2006, he did admit to committing two murders in 2005 and 2006, one of which he dumped the victim's body in Crescent Lake in Washington State, which is a very long way from Florida. And he is known for traveling across state lines to get rid of evidence. But I think it would be pretty insane to have him driving literally across the country with a body. And the FBI has reason to believe that both of those murders were committed in or near Washington State, and they don't have him leaving the Pacific Northwest in 2005 or 2006. But he was very tricky, and it is a possibility. It's just unlikely. And then just in terms of how he committed crime, he didn't really have a victim profile. He was more of a murderer by circumstance. So when he did home abductions, A, he staked out those homes, and he claims, and it's pretty supported by evidence, to only commit home abductions from single-story homes in the suburbs with garage entries that generally are near a master bedroom. So a gated apartment building, a second-floor unit would be way out of his comfort zone. And then, secondly, he claims to, and again, supported by evidence, only got rid of cars across state lines. So police finding her car near her home, again, goes way against his known MOs. And then there's just some other things. He says that the only murder he committed that got any national attention, Samantha Koenig, and the FBI strongly believes, based on evidence, that he only committed murders in 6 to 9 states, and Florida is not believed to be one of those states. So that's kind of the evidence I have. And, you know, who knows, maybe I'll get this FOIA request back and there will be evidence that says otherwise. But I feel like that's pretty strong evidence to support that he's not linked to this. And again, I think it goes back to that original statement of, like, we want to believe it's one of these handfuls of killers that we know. But again, most likely it's not. And I think from what I know about her case is that there were elements of it that made it feel personal, and that doesn't necessarily mean family member personal, but it does feel like most likely whoever abducted her was someone she knew, whether in passing or as a friend or family member. And obviously Keys wouldn't fall into that category.
I asked Josh to go a little bit deeper into exactly what we would expect in a typical victim of Israel Keys.
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about Keys is what we know about him is based on really just 3 murders and what he says. And sometimes there's contradictions between what we know based on evidence versus what we know based on what he's told police. But looking at his crimes holistically, he was so meticulous, and this is what I find interesting about him, that sometimes he only traveled with cash, and he would never travel direct. So he would, what made him kind of famous as a serial killer is he would fly from either Seattle or Anchorage, which were near where he lived. He would fly to, like, Chicago and then in cash, and then rent a car in cash, drive that car all the way to Vermont, abduct a couple, drive across state lines where he would kill them and then bury their bodies, return the car, or sometimes drive the car to, like, Detroit and then return to Seattle or Anchorage from Detroit, all in cash. So he was very good about not being followed, not being found, not leaving a paper trail. He also generally, and this is a claim thing, we've only been able to support the claim in one of his killings, would years ahead of time go and bury a kill kit near where his eventual victims would be. And again, so that was to avoid paper trails and to avoid, you know, receipts of him buying materials that we'd use to kill or cover up a crime. What we do know is every crime that he is linked to, with the exception of his most recent, which is what the FBI believes was him getting lazy and getting sloppy, as most serial killers tend to do, which is usually what gets them caught, is he would always go across state lines. So, pick up a victim in one state, murder them in another state, bury their body in another state. He would do this with cars and travel as well. He claims that all the cars he took were dropped off within or beyond 100 miles from his crime. He usually submerged them in bodies of water. He was also an arsonist. So if water wasn't around, he would set the car on fire or set a building on fire that either his victims or the car was in. That is pretty supported by evidence. He also was a bank robber, and that's generally how he got the cash to support his travel to murder people. So he's so meticulous, so planned, so well thought out, that's why he remains to be one of the most mysterious serial killers, because there's just not a lot of paper evidence to track him or connect him to anything.
In talking with Josh and thinking about what we'd researched about Keyes over the months, I think it's time for us to say that we don't think there's a connection from Israel Keyes to Jennifer's disappearance. The more I thought about it, I have to agree with the point that Josh was making, that we tend to see what we are familiar with. Some aspects of the way that Israel Keyes operated seem to match up with Jennifer's case, but it's because we're trying to make them connect, which is just an ineffective way of making connections in any investigation. And I'm guilty of it. I think probably all of us are guilty of it at some point. The evidence is suggesting that he wasn't responsible for Jennifer's disappearance. The records of his travel, the specific things that he looked for in choosing victims, and so on. To continue looking at him, we'd be guilty of trying to shoehorn him and the evidence together. So we're going on the record today saying that we do not consider Israel Keyes a viable suspect in Jennifer's disappearance. And that may not move us closer to finding who is responsible, but it does for us close an avenue of investigation, opening it up for other things that will move us closer. Keyes' story is one that is still worth exploring, however, just not from the point of view of Jennifer's case. And the little time that I've looked into it, and in talking to Josh, it's so compelling, and I want to know more. Josh is hoping to release his new podcast covering Keyes through the lens of America's true crime obsession later this year. It's going to be called True Crime BS, and he already has social media accounts set up so that you can keep up to date with the progress and the release. Just search for True Crime BS on Twitter or Facebook. And I'll also leave links in the show notes. I also want to send a big thank you to Josh for taking time out of his schedule to chat with me, and I encourage you to check out his other podcasts too. The Karen and Ellen Letters is a serialized tale of two girls, their found correspondence, and a journey into cognitive dissonance. It's equal parts comedy and mystery. He also hosts Our Americana, which explores unique small towns across America, through stories that impact, cultivate, and challenge community. And finally, a music podcast called Playlist, where podcasters of all genres come together to share their favorite music. They're all worth checking out, and I'll leave links in the show notes. Also, stay tuned to the end of this podcast to hear more about Our Americana. As always, thank you for listening and for participating. The whole reason we did this episode was because of you. I didn't even know a thing about Keyes until some of you sent him our way. And while we don't think he's involved, it was still important for us to consider it. Every stone unturned has been our goal, and this was a stone that needed to be kicked. If you think you may know something about the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey, the time to come forward is right now. Call the Orlando Police Department and ask to speak to the detective in charge of Jennifer's case. Call the tip line, call us, doesn't matter, just call someone. Until next time, this has been Unconcluded. Music in this episode is by PC3.
Hi, this is Hannah from the Film Rose Podcast.
Hi, I'm Jen.
My name's Vanessa.
Hi, my name is Stacy, and I listen to Our Americana because it reminds me how important community is.
Because it tells the stories of people and places in small-town America that we'd never get to hear about anywhere else.
I love hearing about parts of our country that I didn't even know existed.
And the reason I listen to Our Americana is for the stories. Stories of average Americans, stories that I otherwise may have never heard.
I liked hearing about the younger generation moving back home to these small towns or moving out of these big cities because they were so passionate about community.
The podcast has definitely inspired me to want to visit America. Despite being such a huge nation, it is clearly the people and communities which give it its heart and soul.
Not only is Josh a great narrator, but he's a great listener. He's very good at capturing the essence of people and the essence of a small town.
Our Americana changes the way I look at America. It's not just my little town with my little struggles.
Josh tells stories I didn't even know I needed to hear and gives small town America a platform to shine.
I'm Josh Hallmark, the host of Our Americana. I spent 6 months living in a van, traveling the country in search of what it means to be American. What I found was community and connectivity. And so I created a podcast to celebrate that. And what better place to start than small town America? Whether it's the West Virginia mining town where a gay club is the center of the community, or a seaside village that was adopted by an orphaned orca, or a Minnesota town that was revitalized by a dog. The heart of these stories is always community coming together in spite of their differences for the greater good. America is so much more than what we see on the news, and Our Americana celebrates that. You can listen to Our Americana on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, and all your other favorite podcatchers.